Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, we are live, even though you're not going to hear it live, from the Blog Talk Radio Performance Center here in scenic Hudson County, New Jersey. I am professional wrestling's premier analyst, Patrick Rivera, and he is professional wrestling's premier journalist, the good professor, Fernando Uribe. Fernando, how you doing today, pal?
I love this intro. What's going on, brother?
I had a cup of coffee, so you know, I'm a little ready to go, but I'm just really excited to talk about a lot of the happenings in the world of professional wrestling / sports entertainment / whatever you want to call it. You know what it is, you know you love it. You're going to keep complaining, but you're still going to keep watching, and we're going to keep bringing you our opinions and our hot takes every other week or every other week, you know. But whatever. Anyways, folks, it's great to be back with you. I feel like it's been forever. Doesn't it feel like it's been forever?
Yeah, man. It was a few weeks. I know our schedules got a little busy here, but, you know, it's really the height of WrestleMania season. And with a few weeks to go, there's a lot to talk about, bro.
Yeah, absolutely. WrestleMania is definitely starting to pick up. I mean, a lot of the shows are getting a little bit more interesting. And obviously AEW, they're getting pretty interesting too, as well as New Japan and a lot of the other companies worldwide. But first off, we're going to start off with AEW Revolution 2022, which happened this past Sunday from the University of Central Florida's facility, I believe, their athletic facility there out in Florida. And AEW, I got to say, for the most part, I wasn't too big on this show. There were some bright spots, but I think it's time, you know, we kind of just dissected. So in the first match, we had Chris Statlander against Layla Hirsch. Now, I got a soft spot for Layla Hirsch. I met Layla Hirsch some years back. She's an absolute sweetheart, one of the toughest women I've ever met. And, you know, obviously I was rooting for her, but nice to see Layla get the win here. Professor, what do you think about this one?
I'm a big fan of Layla Hirsch, too. I got a chance to meet her some years ago, too, at an indie show, and she's a nice girl. I know she's been catching a little bit of fire lately. Obviously, there are a lot of things going on in the world today, man, global politics. Obviously, her being Russian certainly has brought some vitriol to her online and unjustifiably. So,
unfortunately,
you know,
unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately, Marx can be just cruel and heartless, but I think she's handled herself with some grace right now during a very difficult time for her homeland. Obviously, it's not her fault. Obviously, let's not, you know, look at Russian people, men and women, with a negative eye. It's not them. It's their oppressive regime and government. But Layla Hirsch, again, as a professional wrestler, is just doing her job. Nice to see her pick up a win where, for the most part, all her wins have been on AEW Dark or Dark Elevation. So at least, you know, I wasn't happy she was on the pre-show, but again, she was still out in front of a nice crowd. Good win for her.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought she shone pretty brightly in that one. I'll be honest, I thought Chris Statlander would get the win, obviously, because she's an AEW fan favorite, but nice to see Layla get the win. By the way, Profe, did you know that I saw her once squash an apple with her hand, her bare hand? Did you know that?
I did not, but I believe it. She's tiny, but she's strong, man. You can tell that the girl can squat and can lift weights, and I mean, she's in great shape.
Yeah, she definitely packs quite the punch. And speaking of punch, the next matchup was a guy that has been punching all the AEW fans either in the heart or in the gut. We're talking about
Jesus.
Hook. We're talking about Hook. Hook taking on QT Marshall. I got to be honest, I'm not buying this. I'm not buying this at all. I'm not buying that Tom Holland, I mean, he's not even Spider-Man in this one. But I'm just not buying that Hook could beat this guy up. I mean, Marshall looks like your average Jersey Shore bodyguard, you know, or Jersey Shore bouncer at a nightclub. I mean, he looks like he would beat this dude up. So for me to kind of buy this just because he's Taz's son, it's a little tough. I understand the whole suspended disbelief in pro wrestling, but it just it does nothing for me. He's obviously over with that crowd. I don't know. What else would you like to add to that?
Listen, you hit the nail on the head on everything there. QT Marshall looks like he's reliving his days as the bouncer at Karma, the famous Jersey Shore nightclub where the show was filmed for MTV some years back. So I don't know. Apparently,
R.I.P., bro. R.I.P.
R.I.P., yeah. It seems like I think Charlie Harper from 2.5 Men called. He wants his shirt back there. It seems like he's rocking those every week. But listen, the thing that bothers me about Hook is you said it perfectly about suspending disbelief. You know, people online, especially a lot of the marks online, have taken very critically to Bron Breakker, Bronson Steiner, the son of Rick Steiner, the nephew of Scott Steiner. That guy looks believable. He's an athlete. He's 6'2" or 6'3", 260 pounds. Yeah. I mean, he's muscular. He looks like a guy that could literally rip you limb from limb. You look at Hook, and again, not to say I'm in the best position, but he looks like a scrawny kid. And I'm supposed to believe that this scrawny-looking kid, I don't care if he has the black belt like a jiu-jitsu like Brian Alvarez. It's still not believable to me that he's going to beat up a guy like QT Marshall. But again, they're bringing him along slowly. The AEW crowd is eating this nonsense up. What else is there? This is the same crowd that roots for Orange Cassidy and thinks that guy is over or it's a compelling gimmick. But, I mean, hey, whatever. Tony Khan is appeasing Taz. We'll see what this kid turns into. But listen, again, can he hit a gym sometime? Can he do a little more cardio? I mean, the guy is as scrawny as hell.
I kind of look at it like this. I like the gimmick. I think the gimmick is interesting, especially from a young wrestler, because a lot of the young wrestlers nowadays all want to be flyers and they want to hit strong style stuff and their fancy spin kicks and all this other stuff. And here's this kid who wants to come in, use judo throws, amateur wrestling. I mean, and I get it and I respect it, but that works for a guy like Kyle O'Reilly, because Kyle O'Reilly, the legitimacy is a part of the gimmick. His physique, he looks more, physically imposing than this kid. Obviously, he's a young kid, but, I don't know. I'm just not buying it. I'm just not buying it. Does he have potential? Absolutely. I think if they tweak this gimmick, then maybe we'd be looking at it in a different light. Moving on, we had the House of Black, Malakai Black, Buddy Matthews and Brody King taking on Pac, Penta Oscura, and Eric Redbeard. I honestly didn't even watch this. I'll be 100% honest. I had no interest in it. I think all the involved are great workers, but it just really wasn't. It wasn't really anything I was into. I'll be honest.
I'm with you again. I like the addition of Buddy Matthews. I think he's a good worker. He's got a certain size. It seems like he's been hitting the gym lately. Obviously, by his physique, for God's sake. Nice to see Eric, Eric Redbeard, Alex Abrahante is there. We don't know if that's going to be a permanent employment right now with him. I think the match served its purpose to round out the pre-show, and that's exactly what it did.
Yeah, it was just basically there to kind of be a filler match. So now I think the main card at this point has started, and I think the opening match was Chris Jericho taking on Eddie Kingston. I have not been a fan of Jericho's work, I'll be honest, for quite some time now. The guy can get himself over by hook or crook. He's still one of the better talkers in the business, for sure. And Eddie Kingston, obviously, is a fantastic talker, real underdog story. I mean, just this hard-nosed, gritty dude from New York, Irish Puerto Rican guy. I thought the match was pretty decent. It was good for what it was. It's not really something I would particularly go out of my way to see, but Eddie Kingston picked up the big win there. And I think that win obviously meant a lot more for Eddie than Jericho. What about you?
I'm with you, certainly. I think the way Eddie's been portrayed, he's always been an underdog. He always makes matches competitive, but again, finds a way to lose, whether it was with CM Punk or Moxley or whoever. I think a lot of people were expecting maybe the way this program was going for a couple of weeks that Kingston was probably going to get the win. And again, you started seeing a slow transition of Chris Jericho. You started seeing him, say heelish things, do heelish things in the ring. And obviously, to no one's surprise, this past week on Dynamite, I think it came, it pretty much it came to its conclusion. Chris Jericho became a full-fledged heel, turning on Eddie Kingston, certainly destroying what's left of the Inner Circle, per se, and creating a new faction. So I think that this started, we saw the seeds being planted for weeks between Jericho and Kingston. I think you saw a little bit of it marinating at the pay-per-view. And, of course, this has been Dynamite. Again, the flower has gone into full bloom here.
Yeah, yeah. I'll be honest. Past this match, I really don't have much interest in this. Eddie, the Puerto Rican Tom Sizemore, Eddie is, you know, he's an interesting guy. I'm glad to see that he's starting to get these rubs and getting these wins over these bigger guys. And hopefully it kind of helps him out and he moves up in the card.
Well, again, he's like
their Tommy Dreamer in a way.
Yeah, listen, he's a guy, I think he's 40. Again, that's not old per se, but in wrestling years, you're getting up there. He's been on the scene forever. His body obviously has taken a lot of punishment over the years. He's a guy you want to root for. Again, he's a New Yorker, rocks that proud, you know, pinstripe NY on the hat. So I love that.
That's
I know
right.
You do, you know, and again, he's a guy you want to root for. And I think the Tommy Dreamer reference is perfect. The only difference is at least, you know, he got a win on a pay-per-view. I don't ever remember Tommy Dreamer ever getting a win on a pay-per-view.
Well, Tommy won the world title finally at the fucking ass end, the very ass end.
Yes, yes.
So that was something. The next matchup was the Jurassic Express, the AEW Tag Team Champions, Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus, defending their championships against Red Dragon, Kyle O'Reilly, and Bobby Fish, and the Young Bucks, Matt and Nick Jackson. First and foremost, I just want to say, before I say anything else, that I respect the athleticism and the ability of all of these wrestlers in this match. Regardless of whatever flaws I might feel they have, which Jungle Boy is a charisma vacuum, I'm not really buying a 6'7" lizard. The Young Bucks, they're just outrageous already with the fucking high spots and everything else. And Red Dragon's fantastic. But this match was absolute overkill. I mean, it got to the point in the match, Fern, where I was honestly thinking one of these guys is going to stab or shoot the other one to pick up the win. Because that's, I mean, how you kick out of all of those pile drivers, how you kick out of all of those super kicks, how you kick out of everything that these guys took in these matches, in this match, excuse me, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous.
I'm with you.
Not
with
a fan
you.
Of the match. I understand the segment of the audience that it pleases, but it was overkill.
I'm with you. And listen, and especially the week of that we learned that Vince McMahon was inducting The Undertaker into the Hall of Fame. I mean, we saw so many tombstone pile drivers this past weekend on AEW Revolution, and everybody kicked out of them. And I said, wait a second. Talk about suspending disbelief. One of the most iconic finishers in the history of professional wrestling, and like these 5'10", 6 feet guys are kicking out of like tombstone pile drivers. I mean, I thought the tag team title match in September in Chicago at All Out was a spot overkill match. This was overkill on steroids, HGH, and whatever other performance-enhancing drug you can think of. That's what this match represented.
Not a fan. Not a fan at all. I mean, look, I get it. They're all athletic. They're all feeling it. I appreciate the enthusiasm as a fan, as somebody who's been in the ring before. But, like, it's just overkill, man. It's just overkill. And it gets to the point where it's like, okay, where are we going to go from here now? And when you get to that point, it's like, well, who's going to break what to do it? And it really shouldn't have to get to that point. I think these guys are talented enough. If they relied a little bit more on the psychology in this match, you know, they would do it. But, however, this match was just designed to please a segment of the audience. Moving on, we had the Face of the Revolution ladder match, where the winner gets a shot at the coveted AEW TNT Championship. In this matchup, we saw Keith Lee taking on Wardlow, Powerhouse Hobbs, Ricky Starks, and Orange Cassidy and Christian Cage. Another match where it was just too much. It was just too much. Cassidy got hurt on the BL to the outside on that fucking Tope Suicida, and it was too much. It was entirely too much in this match. All of this to just give a ring to Wardlow. I don't know. I wasn't into it. How about you?
I thought it was, listen, I'm a big Wardlow guy. I think that his progression has been great. We saw that, especially this past week on Dynamite. He cut his first promo ever. And, man, you want to talk about hitting it out of the ballpark. Some guys, you know, sometimes come out flat in their first promo. Michael Wardlow, yes, folks, that's his real name, came out swinging this week on a promo. But back to the match, I mean, it was a spot fest again where someone like Christian Cage, I was concerned for his health. We saw Keith Lee. We saw Orange Cassidy. You know, Powerhouse Hobbs, Ricky Starks. I mean, these are all good workers per se. Actually, I'll take that back. I don't think Orange Cassidy is a good worker. I just think he's entertaining for that audience. But
nah,
again,
I got to argue that. I'm sorry, and I can only say this because I trained once where he trained at Chikara. And all those guys at Chikara know how to work, know how to do what they do. That guy, he wrestled under a hood. You know, he did lucha things and stuff like that. He can work. The gimmick is stupid, but he can work.
Yeah.
He can work.
All right, fair enough. No, fair enough. He can work. Again, but a lot of unnecessary risk taken in this match. We all know how catastrophic a ladder match can be. I think what you saw for weeks now, the slow dissolution of the Pinnacle, especially between MJF and Wardlow, you know, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, obviously, but you've been seeing his star on the rise. So no surprise to anyone, I think, that Wardlow came out to be the winner. And obviously we'll challenge the new TNT champion, Scorpio Sky, coming up next week on St. Patrick's Slam on AEW Dynamite.
Yep. Well, moving on. We had the AEW TBS Women's Championship match. It was Jade Cargill, the champion, defending against Ty Conti. I'll be honest, this match was surprisingly good. It was surprisingly good. Like, these girls put in a shift. Both of them, to me, are money. And depending upon their trajectory, you know, as to where they end up, these are the two people that I could honestly say might be Vince's loss. What do you think?
I'm with you. I think, and by the way, I'm a big fan of smart Mark Sterling. He's a local New York guy, graduate of Hofstra Law School out there in Long Island. So, I mean, I don't know. I just like him. I think what they're doing with Jade Cargill has been, I think, a slow progression as well. As someone who still is very green, I think she's made some inroads. Working with someone who's more experienced, like Ty Conti, I think is helpful. Listen, it remains to be seen. You know, we talk about a lot of marks online like to talk about, oh, Vince misses the mark with these people, excuse the pun, or releases people that he shouldn't, or doesn't give a tryout to certain people, or doesn't hire certain people. I think we still got a long ways to go as to whether or not there'll be buyer's remorse by Vince McMahon concerning Ty Conti and or Jade Cargill. But I'm with you. Surprisingly good match. No surprise to see Jade Cargill win this. I think at some point, you know, they're going to keep elevating her until either she faces Dr. Britt Baker, DMD, or the professor, Serena Dwee, you know, somebody. I mean, at some point, the competition is going to get a little stiffer for Jade Cargill. And you saw that with Ty Conti.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be interesting to see that happen. Next up, we had the dog collar match, one of the big main events. It was Carlos Miguel Punk taking on my Jewish friend, Maxwell Jacob Friedman. Honestly, I got to be real with you here, okay? Like, the build-up, everything I thought was really, really good, really, really good, really excellent. I thought the promos were pretty good. I'm not into it at all, but I can be objective enough to watch this and understand how it could be appealing to somebody. Punk, MJF, actually, when he came out at the pay-per-view, trolled the crowd by coming out to Cult of Personality for a little bit, and everybody thought it was CM Punk, and then he switched his theme music on, and he walked out. His facial expressions, everything that he was doing, everything that these guys did, it meant something. It really, really meant something. And then CM Punk came out to his old Ring of Honor song, Cantare Miseria by AFI. I'm not an emo guy, but again, for what they were trying to do, it was fantastic. It really, really worked. Punk showed an old seriousness. It was interesting to see that familiar guy once again, the guy in the basketball shorts. Overall, the match was a bloodbath, but they told a really good story. And again, they made things mean something. One of the big highlights of the match, really, and the purpose of the match, in my opinion, was really to turn Wardlow into a face. And, you know, in the matchup, Wardlow came down to give MJF the ring and then instead pretended he didn't have it. And then when CM Punk had hit the GTS, I believe, Wardlow had given him the ring and he knocked him out and he won the match. The finish was a little bleh, but again, mm-hmm. all in all, for what it was, the fact that it all meant something, I thought the match was really, really good. What about you, Fern?
I thought it was a good match as well. I'm going to echo a lot of your sentiments. Great synopsis there by you, really sort of breaking this down. And listen, we've seen this buildup of MJF and Wardlow, eventually that breakup. It sort of reminded fans, a lot who've been watching wrestling for a while, of Batista and Triple H, right, from late 2004 into 2005, like that slow progression of eventually breaking away from the teacher, right, and the student, and, you know, obviously yeah. very different than what we were used to with, you know, back with Triple H and Batista collectively. But I think this was pretty well orchestrated match. I got to disagree. I think we've talked off the air about it. You know, MGF right now, it probably is the hottest heel in AEW, if not probably the hottest heel in professional wrestling, because A, he never breaks kayfabe per se. And I think he's a guy who, yeah, whether it's cheap heat, whether you like that or not, I think he's been probably the hottest heel in pro wrestling. Maybe next to Roman. Maybe him and Roman are kind of tied as the best heels in pro wrestling.
Roman's not really a heel. Roman's a cool character. They finally made Roman cool. And the fans boo him because, you know, they boo him. But in terms of being a traditional, a conventional wrestling heel, that's MJF. That's MJF.
Yeah,
he really is.
I agree. And I think that I really was hoping that, and I understand why Punk, you know, went over, but if you're really trying to elevate MJF as a future world title contender, and again, the biggest heel in the company, I thought, you know, hey, he should have gone over. You still have Double or Nothing coming up in a couple of months in Las Vegas. You could do the rubber match, settle the feud once and for all. I don't think it would have been the end of the world or catastrophic for CM Punk had MJF won this. Again, you have Double or Nothing in Vegas in less than 2 months. You could, again, do the finale there. Again, not overly disappointed with the result. And the match I thought was a lot of an homage to previous dog collar matches, whether it was Greg Valentine, Roddy Piper, and other famous dog collar matches.
Well, it was really more about Punk. It was more about Punk's ROH years, which we'll have more on ROH later on. It was more about Punk's ROH years and MJF kind of having this full circle moment with him as a hero. And I got to disagree with you. I think Punk needed to get the win in this because let's be real, MJF really did get the best of him in the promos. The two promos that were good were that one where they kind of worked the crowd. They kind of Andy Kaufman the crowd. And the last one where Punk bled. And it was really more about Punk bleeding, in all honesty. But, you know, I think Punk needed to go over. You can't have MJF go over like that. MJF got his win on him. That's good enough. He technically beat him twice. That's good for his heat. And I just feel like this is something that you could address later on when you ultimately put the strap on Punk. Because you know Punk's going to get a title match. You know? And I think if you set it up for MJF beating Punk for the title, then we're talking an even bigger rub. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's still a lot to go between there now and then. But, I feel you. No, fair points, bro.
Yeah. Well, moving on, we have the AEW Women's Championship match. It's Thunder Rosa challenging the reigning defending champion, Dr. Britt Baker, BMD. I'll be honest, when I saw this, I was like, what the fuck? Okay. They're going to give her a good match, you know, because Thunder Rosa is really one of the chicks that works really, really well with Britt. Britt's a good talker. Britt can do some of the basic things very well, in my opinion. But she just, I don't know, she just doesn't get it. For, like, the position that she's in, she doesn't get it. And Thunder Rosa, I thought, would honestly pick up the win, but they ended up going with Britt in this one. And the match, not very good. I got to say the Ty Conti-Jade Cargo match was better.
Yeah, I'm with you. And again, I think from a wrestling storyline perspective, you kind of thought Britt Baker was going to get the win here. Again, this is all as a result of a year ago when Thunder Rosa beat her in that lights out match, right? Where Britt Baker bled like someone just like she like cut an artery, you know, and that's what got her over with the fans, the heat. And, you know, you figure at some point that she was going to get her revenge.
But it was more about the blood.
I agree.
It was more about the blood. It was more about that image, a girl bleeding. Well, let's be real.
I agree. And I think, but from a storyline perspective, right, and AEW fans are enamored with the term long-term storytelling or long-term booking, you know, this seemed like this was going to be the logical conclusion to this match. And again, it sort of segues into next week again, you know, a year late, literally a year to the day after that lights out match where Britt Baker bled, coming up this week, you know, St. Yeah. Patrick's Slam on AEW Dynamite, right? This may be the conclusion between Britt Baker and Thunder Rosa inside the confines of a steel cage this Wednesday, a year to the day after that famous incident. Britt Baker had to get the win here. Who wins the rubber match next week on Dynamite at St. Patrick's, your day, Slam?
Rosa. Rosa's going to win. Everybody knows it. Everybody knows it. AEW, they telegraph their booking. Let's be real, too. You know? Like, come on. They telegraph their booking. You know that Thunder Rosa is going over on this.
I don't know, man.
You really, really do.
I think Tony Khan really likes having the title on Britt Baker for whatever. Hey, listen, it's self-merch. It's a gimmick that's over with that crowd. I don't see Khan taking that belt off of her anytime soon. I could be wrong. Who knows? Maybe next week inside the steel cage, I might be wrong.
We'll see. We will certainly see. Moving on. We have a singles match coming up next between the best wrestler in the world, that's not named Kazuchika Okada, Bryan Danielson, taking on Jon Moxley. At first, this looked very blah, and they managed to spice it up. The match was hard-hitting. It was excellent. They bled, and Jon Moxley got the win, which I think was right. He definitely should have. And after the match, we saw the debut of the legendary Sir William Regal, Sir Stephen Regal, call him what you want, Darren Matthews, whatever his name is. You saw him come on out and try to mediate the scrum, if you will, between Jon Moxley and Bryan Danielson, and ended up slapping Jon Moxley in the face. And slapping Bryan Danielson in the face and then making them apologize and shake hands. The match I thought was good. I thought this match went very long too as well. But the thing that really made it was Regal. I really think so. How about you?
I'm with you. I'm a little surprised that they brought in Regal in this capacity right now to be sort of an on-air personality, maybe a manager for this potential tag team, which is what I think they're going towards. Again, we don't know what his contractual demands are, what to be asked of him by Tony Khan. He may still be working in the back as an agent, maybe working in creative. Who knows? But I'll be honest with you, this is only going to work if Jon Moxley and Bryan Danielson, coming up in Vegas at Double or Nothing, are challenging the Jurassic Express and winning the AEW tag team titles. I don't like them just being put into a tag team and then just sort of wallowing and fighting Mickey Mouse teams. Again, no disrespect to, you know, the AEW tag team division is kind of thorough. I know it's kind of funny to say that out loud, but they got a lot of tag teams. Now, whether they're good or not, we can debate that. But if Moxley and Danielson are not sort of fast-tracked into the title picture by Double or Nothing, then I don't know what the hell they're doing here. Because let's be honest, you know, if you're gonna join them together as a tag team and put Regal with them. Not that, listen, some teams need a heater or a manager to speak for them. That's not the case here. Regal doesn't need to speak for Danielson or Moxley. They both cut excellent promos on their own. But I think it's refreshing to see Regal out there. What influence it's going to have on how they're perceived as a tag team, again, remains to be seen. If they're not challenging for the tag titles in Las Vegas at Double or Nothing, then again, I think it's another creative misstep by Tony Khan.
Well, hopefully between now and then, they'll have about 14 Dark Elevation matches, and they'll be able to jack up their record so they could finally challenge.
That's right.
In the
yeah.
following matchup on the pay-per-view, we have a Tornado Trios match between the AHFO, Andrade El Idolo, Matt Hardy, and Isaiah Cassidy, taking on the team of Sammy Guevara, the AEW TNT champion, Darby Allin, and Sting. Mm-hmm. This was just more overkill, and Sting literally almost fucking died. Pardon my French. Here on Blog Talk Radio.
Can someone explain to me what the difference is between a six-man street fight and a six-man Tornado Trios match? Because is this semantics here? I mean, what's the difference? I mean, again, I'm a traditional pro wrestling fan. Can we just call it a six-man street fight where it's inferred that everyone's just going to be everywhere and anywhere fighting? I don't like Tony Khan. I get why he does it. He's paying homage either other promotions, but at the end of the day, just call things what they are. It's a six-man street fight.
Yeah, it was just unnecessary, all of it. And you know, thankfully Sting didn't get hurt seriously or die. It was just way too much. In the next matchup and in the main event of the evening, it was the AEW World Championship match, where Adam Cole, baby, challenged Hangman Adam Page for the AEW World Championship. At this point in the show, because all the matches had gone so long and I had kind of seen what I already wanted to see, I was just done. I was done. And I really had no interest in this. I've had no interest in this program. Both guys are very excellent workers, but I just really didn't care. Hangman Page retained. And from what I heard, was a good match. It really did nothing for me. How about you?
Listen, everyone who follows me on social media knows how big of an Adam Cole mark I am. I even have an Adam Cole baby coffee mug from AEWshop.com I just got delivered recently. So, for a card that went almost to midnight, I mean, just looking at some stats here, this match went 25 minutes and 45 seconds. The Punk match went exactly 1 minute over that. And then you had, you know, the tag team title match was about 18:55. I mean, this was a long pay-per-view. And I think by the end of the night, you could tell the collective buzz in the building was eroding. And I'll be honest with you. I mean, I stay up because I'm a wrestling fan, and obviously I'm an Adam Cole mark. But I thought the match could have been a little bit better. And even Jim Cornette this week with Brian Last, I think, summed it up perfectly too. You had an obscene amount of finishers and high spots where in any other match, a regular guy would have been out for the count. But they hit, I don't know, how many Panama Sunshines, how many super kicks, a suplex onto the floor. It just seems like, to your point about the tag team title match, short of stabbing someone, puncturing an organ, or just hitting someone with a bottle over the head and letting him bleed out, I don't know what it takes to win matches anymore in AEW. That's what it felt like here. Again, I would have liked Adam Cole to win because I'm a fan. I think Hangman's title run has been very uneventful. It's been very, very blah. Again, I don't know what the merch sales have been. It clearly hasn't done anything in the ratings because we've only seen Dynamite crack a million only three times so far in 2022. And it's not a very eventful title run. But, again, Tony Khan is pushing Hangman to the moon, and he's going to die on that hill with Hangman right now as the champion, and it seems like that's the direction they're going.
Yeah. Tony was really all about the homers that night. You could tell right from the beginning he was going with all the AEW people as far as booking went. He certainly stuck to it for the duration of the program. And all in all, just was not really into the show outside the two matches, I got to say, the Punk and the Bryan match. As far as the show goes, I think in terms of, which we'll be doing here, one high, one low for this program. For me, the one high was, Regal Regal was the high. Regal was just, it was fantastic, and it kind of helped round out that match. And the low for me was, even though I'm not an Adam Cole guy, you know this, Adam Cole not winning the title because Hangman is kind of just a lame duck champion. How about you, Profe? How you feel?
I would say the high for me on this one, believe it or not, was Jade Cargill and Ty Conti. I mean, that ended up being a better match than I expected. And it was a better match than the other women's title match. And I think that was my high for the evening. Again, you're seeing a slow progression of Jade Cargill. She's getting better. I think you can see that she's trying to get better. Her interview promo skills are sensational. She's playing up the heel, the whole, oh, I'm the bitch that runs this place angle. That's great. You want that. You want that cocky, arrogant, full of herself type of heel. That's great. That's my high. My low, again, I would just say that it was the main event, you know, and not necessarily because of the result. I would have liked Adam Cole to win, but it's just, it's a reminder that Tony Khan is just, I think he's living and dying on hills creatively and booking wise with certain people that aren't really drawing. And I think that's the miss in a title match. Again, that as we approach midnight on the East Coast, Monday morning, you know, that was a long pay-per-view. And again, Revolution is not their marquee event. You know, if you're telling me it's All Out or Double or Nothing, I can live with that. But, you know, I can't remember what the Full Gear, I'm sorry, that was the pay-per-view in November. That went like 3 and something, and that was good, and that was fine. This was going almost 4 hours and change, and I'm sorry. I think that Tony Khan's got to do a better job making these shows a little more succinct and a little more concise.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think they need to be a lot more digestible for the viewer. I mean, people have really short attention spans nowadays, and it's not even a generational thing. I mean, like, everybody has a phone in their hands. And if something's not interesting, people are going to take a peek at their phones. This show was just entirely too long, and outside of those 2 to 3 matches, which I will include the Ty Conti-Jade Cargill match, which had a kiss in it. A kiss, a lesbian kiss, if you will, which we haven't seen something like that since the 90s, really. Let's be real. Outside of those 3 things, it was just, it was okay. But everything else was just excessive, over the top, and not really anything worth running home about. In other news, Tony Khan did announce this past week on Dynamite. Last week Tony Khan announced the purchase of Ring of Honor and Ring of Honor's videotape library. When I first had heard the rumors of this, I gotta say, I kind of had a feeling he was gonna do it, because he needs content, and more importantly, content doubles or triples in value depending upon what kind of content it is when you sell it to somebody else, a la Vince, which Vince, once again, being the innovator, laying out the playbook on how to do it. Tony Khan bought the Ring of Honor library, which I kind of had a feeling he was going to do because he's looking to start up some type of streaming service for AEW. And I think that purchasing their content, their library, ties in with a lot of the talent that they have, a lot of the talent that they're probably going to get. And I think it kind of helps them get to that space where they can kind of do their own thing and no longer have to rely on Fight or anybody else like that. Any thoughts on it?
Well, listen, it had been discussed in the wrestling news pipeline for some months now. Apparently it was leaked out that some years ago Vince was interested in buying Ring of Honor. That didn't come into fruition. Again, we all, you know, and that'll lead us into our main topic today. You know, how dependable and accurate that was, right, when it comes to wrestling journalists. You know, that, again, we'll never really know. But this, you know, last week, Tony Khan made that purchase, and I think we all know that the reason for that was for the library, right? I mean, apparently Tony Khan has been talking with HBO Max and some other streaming services. He'd like to create an AEW network to some extent or some streaming service for AEW. I think it makes him much more attractive when you have the Ring of Honor library there, which, let's be honest, we're talking about 10-plus years of incredible shows, talent that we've grown up watching.
20.
From Brian
Danielson.
20. 20. 20. 20. That's right. That's right. Yes, that's right. Impact Wrestling and Ring of Honor turned 20. That's right. That's right. And, you know, guys we grew up watching from Brian Danielson to AJ Styles to CM Punk to Kevin Owens to the, you know, the Young Bucks to other great stars we've seen in the business come up, and Ring of Honor was a launching pad for them. So, again, I think it's a smart move now. Again, $40 million is a lot of money for a company that, again, is not right now functional. But, again, maybe the library itself, maybe that's what, that's probably worth its weight in gold to Tony Khan. Now, we'll see what the ROI will be, the return on investment for Tony Khan, because if you're going to do this, then you have to kind of fast-track an app or a streaming service kind of quick. I know they're very busy and a lot of money's invested in the video game, which, again, remains to be seen how good it's going to be. If you want to get into the competition and get subscribers, you can't really dilly-dally with this. I'm not saying you have to have a streaming service tomorrow, but at least by the fall, there should be something on our smart TVs that AEW is putting out. Anything later than this year, I think, is a disservice, and it's not going to be profitable for Tony Khan. He just spent $40 million on purchasing this. I mean, it's got to get, again, a return on it for his money relatively sooner than later.
Yeah, absolutely. That was actually reported earlier this week by Billy Boddy, who appears on Keeping It 100 and a lot of other podcasts. Generally, this information that he gets is pretty accurate, and he was reporting some pretty staggering numbers for AEW. That, you know, they get $40 million from TNT, and their top 20 wrestlers combined is about $30 million. And then they still have to pay for all the production. They have to pay, well, I mean, some, you know, even though he owns the place, if they were to run at Daly's, let's say, you know, he still has to pay those people. He still has to pay all the camera people. He has to pay the production people. He has to pay, I mean, tons and tons of grips and hands and stage hands and all this other stuff. So, you know, between that and then doing a video game from scratch and then purchasing Ring of Honor for $40 million, I mean, he's spending a lot of money. But from what was reported, his initial business plan had estimated that he would spend about $100 million over the first 5 years. He's on track this year to spend $90 million. I mean, I get that the guy's a billionaire. I get that, that he's got a ton of money, but $100 million is $100 million. Whether it's to a poor man or a rich man. So I don't know. It's a little alarming, but we're going to have to see what happens. I mean, I just think a lot of this stuff kind of stems back to when AEW was originally, you know, founded, and when AEW, you know, was signing a lot of these indie guys with buzz, but not a lot of experience, not a lot of fundamentals. And not really going out there and looking for guys who had been on TV, whether it be on Impact or WWE or, you know, Japan, Mexico.
And those contracts were low. And those contracts weren't as burdensome on the payroll.
Well, they overpaid some indie guys, though. No. They overpaid those indie guys, man. I mean, they gave these dudes six figures, man. Six figures, though, but like high six figures. You know, for an indie guy who's never worked TV, who probably can't even show you a hard cam, I mean, dude, that's crazy. When he had a ton of WWE guys, a ton of TV-ready guys that were already out there. It's alarming.
No, you're right,
it's
about
a bit alarming,
that. No,
I gotta say.
No, you're right about that. But again, in the last calendar year, what have we seen Tony Khan do? I mean, certain guys have become available, from Brian Danielson to CM Punk and Adam Cole to others, where – they're marquee names that you know because they've been in the biggest promotion in the world with WWE. And obviously they've been household names in other promotions, whatever. The bottom line is that, you know, Tony Khan had to roll the dice. And yes, it's a lot of money. It kind of makes you wonder where, you know, is this an endless supply of currency that he has out there in Jacksonville because of his father, Shad Khan? And, you know, again, it remains to be seen what the return on investment is going to be here. Yes, the Punk contract is probably paying itself off because of all the merch sales, and that's considerable. Same thing with Brian Danielson, maybe to some extent others. You know, I mean, I'd like to think Adam Cole's in there. I don't know. I haven't looked at those numbers. But the bottom line is that, you know, Tony Khan, again, we've talked about this in other episodes. Tony Khan has to push his chips to the middle of the table. You have to kind of take a gamble here. If you're trying to compete with Vince, which he's not going to be competing with Vince. But if you want to be an alternative to wrestling fans, you have to kind of bring in marquee names, and it's going to cost you. It's just like you can't nickel and dime it anymore. Listen, you know how much of an Impact Wrestling fan I am as they turn 20 years this year. What has Impact been able to do in recent years? They've been able to be resourceful with their contracts. They're not overspending for a lot of people. They know what that's like. They did that a decade ago. It didn't work for them. You know, they're trying to be a little more resourceful. They have less money to work with, but they're being resourceful. Tony Khan can't do that. Tony Khan can't be frugal right now. Tony Khan's got to go push his chips to the table. And I think that's what he's trying to do. Whether it works, that remains to be seen.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, our main topic for this show is about wrestling journalists. And I feel personally that it would be terrible of me not to ask you to introduce this next segment because you are, in fact, a journalist yourself. So, Professor, the floor is yours. Please introduce our topic for this episode of Working the Marks with Fernando and Pat.
Well, I'll tell you, this week's topic, ladies and gentlemen, I think it should resonate with a lot of us who are fans, who browse the internet hourly, whether it's looking at certain websites or listening to certain podcasts. But I think we're going to just pretty much ask a question, you know, wrestling journalists, do we love them or hate them? You know, are they doing us a disservice? Are they being dishonest? I think these are all valid questions for us. And as someone who takes pride in being a good journalist, and I get that sometimes for people that look at my brand of opinion journalism, you know, it's coming from a very conservative point of view. I'm citing certain things that maybe favor my agenda or my point of view or my politics. But, you know, when it comes to wrestling journalism, it should be pretty much cut and dry, and it's not. And for us that have grown up from the infancy of the internet to read, you know, to the old chat rooms on AOL, I'm sort of dating myself here, to even reading, you know, tangibly the old Wrestling Observer newsletter, which I never did, or reading PW Torch, or reading The Slammer in the New York Daily News back in the day. You know, we kind of hoped that what we were reading was legit, was reliable, was researched, was accurate. And I think what we've seen, Patrick, is for years now, the evolution of the internet, more websites, it's easy. Listen, it's not expensive to just go on GoDaddy or other platforms and start a website. And if you want to start a new service of any kind, you know, it's cheap. It's pretty affordable. And if you are reading dirt sheets or collaborating or reading on Twitter, reading on Instagram and Facebook, anyone can call themselves a pro wrestling journalist these days. But I think we have to be careful about where we get our information from and who we're relying on. I mean, listen, let's be fair. I mean, let's look at the sort of the regression of someone like Dave Meltzer, who for a lot of years was regarded as a wrestling historian, was a preeminent journalist, just like Wade Keller, who's still the editor-in-chief of Pro Wrestling Torch. And that's a reliable news source because he hasn't let the fame get to his head. That's not you can't say that about Dave Meltzer and the Lollipop Guild, which includes Brian Alvarez and the rest of the Insufferable Bunch that make up Wrestling Observer Live. But I think that right now we're living in a time where, you know, even wrestling journalists, I think, are having a really toxic effect on how we look at the business and how we look at the product. I mean, we're fans. We like what we like. You know, we cheer our favorites. We boo the people we hate, you know, the heels. But I think that wrestling journalists now are now joining in on this. And that's not their job, okay? That's not their job. One thing is to be a journalist. If you're saying to me that Dave Meltzer is an opinion journalist, okay, I can live with his critique of what he's trying to do, okay? But he's not an opinion journalist. He's trying to portray himself as still a legitimate sort of bread and butter, meat and potatoes, roll up your sleeve type of journalist. That's not what he is anymore. Wade Keller? No, Wade Keller would say he's still pretty reliable. But the bottom line is, if you're going to be doing opinion and critiquing something, then don't call – you have to be consistent. You have to call yourself an opinion journalist. Case in point, I don't run a news site. I don't break news. I don't publish stories on a daily basis on my podcast page. I am critiquing politics. That's called opinion journalism. No one's going to call me a traditional journalist because that would be foolish. And that's the problem when it comes to wrestling journalism. We're seeing journalists that have kind of worked in the business for some time, and now instead of calling themselves what they really are, they're sort of masquerading as legitimate journalists in the field where, let's be honest, it's been lacking in real journalism for a long time.
I think you pretty much summed it up really, really well. Dave Meltzer used to be a tool for the boys. He was a resource for the boys. As discussed in the ill-fated podcast Putting It Over with Pat, you can find those on YouTube. Just incredible on Putting It Over with Pat. That show fell so fast they thought Herb Abrams was perking it, but you know, Meltzer was a resource for the boys. You know, he used to help the boys, you know, work in different territories, connect with people because he knew all these other people. And he was really, really helpful. And I just think that the way AEW started, the way everything came together, it was incredibly Mark-centric because the person that was financing it was a Mark. And I think that there was a lot of times probably where things that Tony Khan said probably took wrestling people a certain way, you know, or maybe felt them, maybe made them feel a certain type of way because he's not initiated to what wrestling is about. He doesn't understand what wrestling is about, you know. I only understand a very tiny microcosm of what wrestling is about from what I saw and from what I learned. And it's very much a brotherhood. It's very much, you know, its own thing. And there's certain things that you have to respect in terms of booking, in terms of wrestlers, in terms of just a lot of different things that fans do not take into consideration. And Tony Khan cannot do that because Tony Khan did not break into the business, did not learn, did not, you know, do all these other things, you know, that people who worked in the business did. He just had a lot of money. So, you know, in essence, as the boys would say, he didn't pay any dues. He kind of just walked in because he had a lot of money. And if the dude who's paying everybody is a Mark, then the company's going to be Mark-centric. And I think the fact that Marks don't like Vince is because Vince is not a Mark. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? Does that little thing just make sense to you right now?
No, it certainly does.
You know?
I think we go back to people like Meltzer, again, the rest of his entourage that do wrestling. And again, folks, you know, listen.
But it's enabled them.
No, it's enabled it. And what's even worse, again, and listen, folks, I'm no one to tell you how to spend your disposable income, but is there a bigger waste of money monthly for anyone to tell me that they're spending $11.99 a month to pay for Wrestling Observer Premium packages? And when you can simply go online and you can read whether it's PW Torch, whether it's to some extent PW Insider, Billy Body also mentioned exceptional journalist. Like, the idea of paying for resources like this is mind-boggling to me. You have to be a really invested, whether it's pro wrestling, whether it's ESPN Insider. Like, there's enough information out there in the regular apps, whether it's Fox Sports, ESPN, Barstool. The idea you want to pay for premium packages when it comes to this stuff is mind-boggling to me. I don't like it. I think it's a waste of money when there is a plethora of resources. Now, again, you got to do your homework. You can't fall for anything and everything that's published online. We get that. But to the point of wrestling journalists is that now they're corrupting the ability of fans to think objectively. I'm a Mark for certain wrestlers. I get emotional and partisan about certain guys. But when I need to be objective, I can be objective, whether it's on this show about pro wrestling, about politics, believe it or not, about sports in general. The problem is that there are a lot of wrestling journalists that don't practice that, and they're making this climate toxic. You can't kill – again, and I hate Goldberg with a passion. I hate Goldberg with a passion of 1,000 white suns, okay, boiling in the universe, okay? But you can't go crazy on Vince, you know, dragging Goldberg out there pay-per-view after pay-per-view, whether it's Saudi Arabia or some select pay-per-views, and not go after Tony Khan for dragging out Sting, who Steve Borden is 62 years old, and if he keeps doing these stupid stunts, he's going to die out there. So you got to be consistent, whether it's Dave or others, that killed Vince McMahon for dragging out legends out there who are older, but he doesn't go after Tony Khan. And I think that's just a small example of the blatant hypocrisy that we're subjected to.
It just boils down to the fact that Khan is a mark, and he's a money mark, and Meltzer got cool with him because he's a money mark, and then Meltzer okayed the nonsense that he would probably say, and everybody else did because nobody wanted to tell him, no, man, that's not how that goes. It's like this. Or maybe people did, and, you know, he ended up at odds with them. And then everything else kind of, you know, dissolved or escalated or whatever. But the point is that this is just a Mark domino effect. And everything that Tony Khan has done has emboldened Marks to believe that they understand and know wrestling better because they've watched it for years. But they don't really understand what it's about and what to consistently do to keep people coming back if you're trying to do something like this. Because there's a specific way to book it. There's a specific way to book it, but you have to be in the business. Nobody walks into a fucking operating room, okay, and performs fucking surgery on somebody or whatever and fucking just cut somebody open. You got to go to school for that. You got to go to school for that. You know what I'm saying?
You got
to
be trained.
And it's the same thing with wrestling.
Yeah. Well,
you
got to
be trained.
Absolutely. No, you hit the nail on the head.
But let me just finish with this with this one thought here real quick. You know, this has emboldened all these marks, right? And all these people like Sean Ross Sapp and like all those other people that like, you know, are part of that Dave Meltzer crew. And it's made them think that they know what good and what real wrestling is. And anybody who disagrees with them doesn't know what the fuck they're talking about. But the problem is that there's a lot more people that know more wrestling that disagree than there are people who, you know, are just marks and are just fans. And basically, it's just a big Mark domino effect, honestly.
I'm with you. I think you hit on a lot of points there. And I'll even bring up another example, which is pretty egregious again, and it shows how tone-deaf people like Meltzer and other journalists are when they want to crucify Vince. And again, listen, I think we both talked off the air. I've talked about it on this show. My issues with Vince, again, whether the Peacock or, you know, is accessible or easy to navigate, the stock, I mean – those were all legitimate gripes by me. But at the end of the day, I'm objective enough to know that Vince knows what he's doing. 95% of the time, Vince knows what he's doing. He's gotten it right when it comes to how to push certain people, right? Even during the McAfee interview on YouTube, you saw a different side of Vince where he was just sort of very transparent. He was very sort of, you know, philosophical about how he looked at himself and his body of work. And the problem is that, you know, a lot of these journalists go after Vince and try to nitpick any little thing. Case in point, you know, we're 3 weeks out of WrestleMania and both nights in Cowboy Stadium in Dallas, in Arlington, Texas, are not sold out yet. Well, here's a newsflash for people like Meltzer and all the AEW, you know, apologists. Well, it's a building that can seat over 100,000 people. You know, we're just coming out of COVID. Okay, we're trying to get back to some sense of normalcy. People are going back to work. People are trying to save money. People maybe their disposable income isn't what it is. Okay, let's be honest. If you know about WrestleMania weekend, you got the SmackDown on Friday night. You have the Hall of Fame Saturday night. During the day, you have the NXT Stand and Deliver takeover during the day. You have the Hall of Fame Saturday night. Friday night is the Hall of Fame. Stand and Deliver is Saturday. And then you got night one of WrestleMania Saturday. Then you got, you know, Sunday night, night two. Then you got Monday Night Raw in Dallas. So that's a lot of money that you're asking the people to fork over for the biggest night, for the biggest pro wrestling weekend of the year. Meanwhile, AEW didn't have Revolution at the Amway Center, the home of the NBA's Orlando Magic, which seats 20,000 people. They had to have it at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, right on campus, basically, which it's a nice building, but it seats only 10,000 people. And from what I was reading, I don't think it was a full house. So to crucify Vince about, oh, tickets aren't being sold out yet and Vince is struggling to sell tickets, Vince is going to be fine come WrestleMania weekend. The Cowboys Stadium will be full to the max both nights. The SmackDown will be sold out. The Hall of Fame is sold out. TakeOver will be sold out. Night 2 will be sold out. And Raw will be sold out. So this idea that they try to push this narrative that Vince is struggling is madness. But again, it's these irresponsible journalists that embolden Marks online, as you said, that they think they know more than they do. And it's really, really irresponsible and egregious.
You know what? I'm going to give you a fucking pop. You hear that? That's me. That's me giving you a pop, man.
And let me tell you, and
you
let me tell
deserve
you folks,
it.
And let me tell you something, folks. I know Patrick off the air for some years now. This guy doesn't pop for anybody. So I'm going to take this video afterwards, after the show broadcast. I'm gonna cut it out. I'm going to save it up to my iPhone and put it in the cloud because I cannot lose this for anything. So believe me, Pat doesn't pop for anybody. But thanks, though, man. But, I mean, seriously, this is what drives me crazy about these. Now, again, podcasts are podcasts, whether it's Jim Cornette, whether it's Disco Inferno and Conan, whether it's JR, whether it's Bischoff, whether it's, you know, different people in the business having a podcast and opining. That's different. We can agree or disagree on what we like or we don't like and whether we agree with whoever. This is different now because these wrestling journalists are trying to pass themselves off as like they know the business when maybe they don't. And that's enabling Marks Online to be like dismissive of something that they don't like to hear. And when they hear it, they just shut down. That's unhealthy.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. I think that like as long as this continues, it's only going to get worse. And I think all of it's really dependent upon the success or the failure of AEW. Because at this point, the Marks are just invested in that. And they're going to continue to grow that thing, grow that succubus. I mean, it's a toxic wrestling environment. It really, really is. It really, really is. I mean, the things that people say to one another on there, it's pretty disgusting, man. And I got thick skin. You know, I'm actually a millennial with thick skin. Okay. It's pretty gross. It's pretty gross. Some of the stuff people say, you know, and wrestling and this Mark culture and this whole thing has emboldened it. And it's pretty nasty. And I honestly hope it goes away in the long run. I really, really do. But folks, speaking of go away, we're actually going to go away pretty soon. And, this, I gotta be honest, this whole hosting thing, I feel like I was batting righty, and I'm a lefty. So it was the strangest, most interesting thing. I'm sorry if I bumbled like a baby, but it was for your enjoyment, along with the commentary of the great Professor Fernando Uribe. Profe, you have any closing words before we depart here on Working
well,
the Marks?
Well, I like the format. You know, it kind of gave me the night off a little bit, as they say, from hosting. And I like this nice blend, obviously, a good back and forth, you know, kind of, you know, shake it up a little bit here on the podcast. I think that's healthy. I think it's refreshing to show off our skills on the microphone for both you and I. Real quick, I guess everybody tuning in here, next Saturday night, I'll be in Philadelphia with my cousin Daniel for Impact Wrestling's live show there. On Saturday night in their lead-up to their next pay-per-view in April, Rebellion. So I'll be in Philadelphia. I'll be rocking my Dallas Cowboys gear in the heart of Philly. And, you know, hopefully we'll be able to record our next episode in the next couple weeks after I get a tetanus shot, you know, coming back from the city of brotherly love. But I'm excited for that. And, you know, we'll see what happens in the next couple weeks here with the AEW and obviously with WWE as, you know, WrestleMania is right around the corner.
Well, it's certainly going to be an interesting couple of weeks. Hopefully it gets a lot more interesting. I think it will. And all in all, I think the shows are going to be fantastic in the coming months. I got to say, this is probably me hosting is probably the closest you're ever going to come to taking an edible and seeing what that feels like. You know, I think that's probably what that was. You know, it's like you taking an edible, basically. That's what it was like with me hosting. But, folks, it's been fantastic. Can't wait to talk to y'all again. I'm Patrick. You can check me out at The Child Actors on Instagram. He is Professor Fernando Uribe. We are working the marks, and we will see you very soon. Arrivederci. Thank you.